Hey, covering a turkey.
What are we going to eat for Thanksgiving if we don't eat this turkey?
Ham. Ham. I'm Jewish. I ain't eating no ham.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
The following Rustic Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 40 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson. And today, we'll be taking a look at the year 1995, the first time on this show. Looking at WCW, well, sort of. As I explained in episode 37, WCW Prime from November 20th, 1995, which is what we'll be looking at today. Prime operated in its own universe that had no consequences across the promotion. None of the matches really mattered. Stuff was rarely referenced from other shows. So this is just kind of a little snippet in time for WCW around the Thanksgiving holiday. And with Prime being what it is and what I explained it was a couple of episodes ago, I thought, well, this show might be fun to do right before Thanksgiving, because I have a different show planned for next week. And I thought, well, might as well insert a little Dusty and Cruz on De Prime now while I could. I kind of made it my morning routine to an extent, which I've talked about a little bit, that I was going to start watching this, but it's been interrupted from time to time, and I happened upon this one, and that's how I ended up choosing it. So yes, this is historic episode number 40. I never would have thought that I would have made it this far. And thank you to all the listeners out there who've made this possible, who keep me going on this each week. It's not a real milestone at 40. I'm not entirely sure why I'd be celebrating that. But the number 40, you may not know. And in fact, you've probably never even considered this for 1 second in your life. It is the only number where the letters that spell out the number are in alphabetical order. So F-O-R-T-Y, in perfect alphabetical order. It is the only one. Believe it or not, don't waste your time going through all the numbers and thinking it through in your head. It is really 100% true. Now, before I go any deeper here into show business, not show business, but the show's business here, let me just get some other business out of the way up front. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. You're probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place to Be Nation. Check out all the other podcasts on the Place to Be Nation Pop, Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. And, of course, this one, the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And if you have any Amazon purchases, go to placetobenation.com/Amazon, and a portion of that will be kicked back to help with the site costs of the placetobenation.com. So, right now, this is the first 1995 show that I have done, and I'm glad that I'm doing it now in the 40th episode, because it now means I will have covered at least one show in every year from 1980 through 1999. So with this being the first one from 1995, just a few stats on which shows I've covered over time and which years I've done the most. I mentioned on an earlier episode, I don't know which one it was, I'm starting to lose track of that at this point, that one of my original concepts for this show was that I would only do wrestling from the year 1989, which, and I then realized that I would get bored pretty quick talking about the same stuff over and over again. I have done 5 shows from 1989, so I guess it kind of bled over into that.
There have been four shows from the year 1984, which is a good year because you have a lot of WWF stuff out there. There's a lot of Mid-South available, and then you have all sorts of other territories as well. AWA was still going strong at that point. And I've done three shows from 1986, 1988, 1991, and 1992. So I'm not sure what all that means, but you know, there are certain years that I like more than others. It seems like 88 is a strong one for me because that was the year I started watching. Obviously, 89 and 84. I'm surprised that I have not revisited 1987 since the fourth episode, which, if you want to go back into the archive, that was the Superstars with the Hogan, Andre, Piper's Pit, where Andre completed the heel turn and took Heenan as his manager. So certainly go back in the archives on SoundCloud, soundcloud.com/greetingsfromallentown. You can find all that there, including the first 15 episodes that were not on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. So we get Thanksgiving coming up next Thursday here in the U.S., and I'm trying to figure out, you know, how much turkey I'm going to have to make, and I figure I might as well laugh about the whole holiday in watching this show. WCW Prime, a show that aired on Monday nights in 1995 and launched in 1995, much earlier in the year than Nitro. I don't know what this Nitro thing is. I've never covered it. I've never covered that Raw show that people talk about. I only cover the truly important things. So yes, WCW Prime is airing on Monday night, presumably against Nitro, on these Prime Sports Network stations across the United States. And there isn't, I decided in prepping for this episode, because I already talked about the history of WCW Prime only three episodes ago, I picked up the book, The Death of WCW, which I read about 3 years ago, and I thought, well, why don't I flip through it and see if WCW Prime is mentioned anywhere in the book? And it is not. That is how relevant this show was to the WCW canon. But to be honest, I really don't care because there's all sorts of fun stuff on every single one of these shows. Chris Cruz, Dusty Rhodes are having a good time doing it. There's a turkey on set. Not an actual turkey, but a guy dressed in a turkey who's doing some very weird things behind Dusty, which I'm going to get into at some point during the course of this show. So you're probably wondering, well, what was going on Nitro that night? I mean, they just had a Hogan Sting match, but of course it had a schmoz finish. This was at the height of weird, paranoid, no mustache, because it had been shaved by Kevin Sullivan, Wrestling Observer Newsletter burning Hulk Hogan, that would culminate in the World War III pay-per-view the following Sunday after this. So that aired on November 26th on pay-per-view. And on this show, we do have a segment which Mean Gene Okerlund runs down the card for the World War III pay-per-view. Meanwhile, on the USA Network, the WWF is running a couple of interesting angles, one of which, in the aftermath of the Survivor Series and losing the WWF title to Bret Hart, Diesel came out in street clothes, beat the hell out of somebody. I believe it was Skip or Zip or one of those guys, and decided that he wasn't going to be a corporate shill anymore and basically let loose at Vince McMahon on the air in kind of a weird shattering of, not quite shattering of kayfabe. And then later on in the show, Shawn Michaels takes an enziguri from Owen Hart, and then about a minute later, he faints. You get EMTs in the ring, and they're trying to do a worked shoot sort of angle there. And of course, that would lead up to Michaels taking time off to go bone Sonny down in the Caribbean or something of that sort. Comes back, Royal Rumble wins, and then that leads into his title reign. So Nitro and Raw both running the best possible things that they could at that time. But this is the Prime, okay? The Prime has the match of the week, and that's good enough for me because, like North Korea, this is this show is totally isolated from everything else and is often hilarious at the same time.
Let me just do a quick rundown as to what we're going to see on this Thanksgiving edition of WCW Prime. We have Eddie Guerrero in action from early in his WCW tenure. We have Ric Flair taking to the ring here in the purple trunks. The Moo match of the week is the Cobra versus Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, who was dealing with some issues at that time, which I'll get into. And I honestly, with this Cobra Orndorff match, I'm really excited to see what the finish is. And we also have the Barrio brothers taking on Scott and Steve Armstrong. I am very excited for that as well. So why don't we just jump right into the show? Before we get to the opening contest, which features, oh, certainly one of my favorite topics to talk about, Chris Benoit, please note the sarcasm here, I have to go to the intro, because the intros on WCW Prime are such a key component of the show, particularly when you have Crispy Cruz alongside the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. And Dusty today is doing his intro from the pumpkin pot patch, because we're just past Halloween, we're looking forward to Thanksgiving. There is somebody in a turkey outfit kind of wandering around behind the Dream. And Chris Cruz is wearing a woman's pilgrim hat. He's very upset about it. So why don't I just throw it to the host of Family Feud, the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes.
This is Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, and we are celebrating Thanksgiving right here on the Prime, WCW Prime. I'm in a pumpkin patch. You can see turkeys walking around and they can't see me because I'm camouflaged Turkey Hunter Day. Not only wrestling, but I will teach you today how to call up a turkey to do the Moon Turkey Match of the Week. And you know, my partner in that is a little bad, so they celebrate Thanksgiving. We got him dressed up as a lady, if you will. Come on in here, Christopher Cruz. Come on, Chris. Come on, Chris. Come on here. Come on in here. Here he is. Look at this. Happy Thanksgiving, Christopher Cruz. Take over.
Now, Cruz here, this is why he is such a professional. He sells his anger at having to wear that woman's pilgrim headdress thing, where he later says that he'll wear it for the on-camera stuff because it's the Thanksgiving edition of Prime, and he's just going to go through with it, but he's not going to be wearing it when he's not on camera and he's calling the matches. I can't picture Tony Schiavone or Mike Tenay or any other WCW announcer going through with this. And that's what makes the Prime so fun, is that Chris Cruz is just a total pro here. Also a total pro is Mark Starr, who is taking on Benoit here. And Mark Starr is the real-life brother of the star of episode 25 of Greetings from Allentown, Chris Champion, who had that Karate Kid gimmick at the time. They are real-life brothers, and they did team together as a team called Wildside way back when. Starr was a bit of a dark match specialist for WCW in 1995. When you have the match before the pay-per-view begins to warm up the crowd, Mark Starr was often in those matches in 1995. So think of him as the WCW version of the Brooklyn Brawler or Coco Beware. He's obviously, he's not as good as Coco Beware, but he's certainly much better as an enhancement guy, I think, than Steve Lombardi, the Brooklyn Brawler. So edge to WCW in that regard. So this is the reckoning here. I have to talk about Benoit again. And you may have noticed in recent shows, I have referred to him as Dave Meltzer's Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Famer, Chris Benoit. And that subject is such a bugaboo to me, because I was out on wrestling for that long period of time in the first decade of this century. So, you know, I wasn't following the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame. Like, obviously, I knew when the Benoit murders took place. Like, that was certainly the biggest story in the history of the wrestling business, when an active guy murders his wife and son. And that kind of goes into this whole observer thing and why it's annoys me so much that, yes, it's fun to have a nice little Hall of Fame that everybody votes and debates on. And the best part of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame is kind of the discussion that goes on around it. You know, that Chris Zellner has done podcasts. I think he did one about 2 or 3 weeks ago with Dylan Hales, talking about various candidates in the ballot, Sputnik Monroe, Junkyard Dog, and others. And he'd done some in the past, dating back to 2015. And I learned things from listening to those. But, okay, so you have this Hall of Fame for a newsletter here. And you have the standard of you have to be active for 15 years and then you go on the ballot at the 15-year mark, whether you're active or not. Now, there's a very good reason why you don't put an active competitor in the Hall of Fame, because stuff can happen down the road. Obviously, you don't expect somebody to kill his wife and child while still active, but those things, you know, you have to consider. There's a reason why Major League Baseball has a 5 or 6 year waiting period, whatever it is. Hockey has a 3 year waiting period, and so on. So you have Benoit go into the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame in 2003. Murders take place 4 years later in 2007. What does Meltzer and company decide to do? He decides to have a recall vote and requires 60% to recall Benoit from this Hall of Fame that's a figment of the imagination. Now, what really bothers me about this is not only requiring a supermajority to remove a double murderer from the Hall of Fame, a double murder that took place while he was active, which I can't stress enough, but, okay, the fact that only 54% voted to remove him from the Hall of Fame, which I don't understand what the hell is wrong with the 45% who said, you know what, sure, he committed a double murder, but we can't judge the guy based on what he did the last weekend. Yes, we can. Absolutely we can. He killed his wife and son. When you kill a 7 or 8 year old, however old Daniel was, I'm sorry. You don't get the benefit of the doubt. We don't get to look fondly on your other work over the years. It just does not work that way. I'm sorry. And the fact that he's still in there, that's why I derisively have used that term the last couple of shows. And I just don't get it. I talked about way back in one of the earlier episodes where there was a WCW match with Benoit, talking about, like, I don't get why people have this attitude that we can just ignore what happened there at the end. And I don't really like talking about this, but I really have to kind of bring this up. Now you say, Pete, he was voted in. It's too late. What can you do? Well, first of all, would Dave Meltzer have lost a single subscriber to the Wrestling Observer Newsletter if he had just said, you know what, I'm unilaterally removing Benoit from the Hall of Fame? Who exactly was going to... Who's the crazy wingnut wrestling fan who says, you know what, this is the hill I'm going to die on. I'm canceling my subscription to the Wrestling Observer Newsletter because he took a guy who killed his wife and son out of his Hall of Fame. Like, who exactly did that? I wouldn't even want such a person subscribed to what I'm putting out there. There are examples over time, some of them after, but some of them before, of people being kicked out or being forced to resign from a Hall of Fame. Darren Sharper, the former football player, was in the William & Mary Athletics Hall of Fame. They kicked him out when he pled guilty on some sort of rape charge a couple of years ago. But the biggest example that came to mind immediately is Allen Eagleson, who you may not know. He was the first leader of the National Hockey League Players Association through the 70s and into the 80s, and he was elected to the Hockey Hall of Fame in 1989. all the while he was defrauding players, most famously Bobby Orr. It's kind of a complex subject, so I don't want to get into it too deep. And he eventually was found guilty or pled guilty or whatever and was eventually forced to resign from the Hall of Fame in 1998, right before the expulsion vote was going to happen. So there certainly is precedent for that. And also, committing fraud against others while a crime certainly ranks below on the scale versus a murder of your wife and your young son. So really, I don't understand why he's there, why he's still honored by anybody. There's a very good reason why WWE distanced themselves from him and why they don't glorify his matches. I will admit, part of it is the fact that they did that tribute show. If they had not done that tribute show, I don't think that they would have run away quite as distantly. But at the end of the day, I think it was the right thing to do. Dusty, for his part here, apparently can see into the future, because this is around the time Benoit had joined the Four Horsemen. Dusty decides to bestow an award upon Benoit.
Speaking of turkey, Chris Benoit is the turkey of the year.
Oh, just wait until 2007, Dream. Just you wait. Star, who was also in the tag team Men at Work, so not only was he a singles enhancement guy, but also one of the more famous ones in a tag team as well, gets in quite a bit of offense here. I was pretty glad to see that. And that's kind of what separates him from a guy like Lombardi, is Star has actual some convincing offense. He does that snap mare thing where he flips over, like what Mr. Perfect used to do in his heyday as Intercontinental Champion. Then he lands a German suplex on Benoit for a taste of his own medicine. That gets a two count. But then he gets crotched on the top rope there and gets back suplex off the top rope. Benoit follows up with the snap suplex, as Cruz mentions the Dynamite Kid as being the inspiration for Chris Benoit. Probably not the best inspiration to have, at least from an all-around perspective. Dusty decides to do what's really popular now on Twitter and other social media. He goes into the whataboutism, where when Cruz brings up the Dynamite Kid, he brings up the suplexes of Joe Blanchard and Dory Funk Jr. Like, what about these guys? Like, sure, this Republican candidate, you know, wanted to date a 14-year-old, but what about this person who died 50 years ago? He was a Democrat and, you know, was with somebody else. I don't know. Dusty seems to be very ahead of his time during this particular matchup. And he picks up the win, Benoit does, with the dragon suplex, which is kind of hilarious because it's a pretty stiff move for something you're seeing on WCW television for the time. And it kind of gets ignored by Dusty, who's just sort of talking. He's still in the middle of making his point of, hey, what about Dory Funk Jr. and all that, which I found kind of good. And, you know, I think it's proper to pretty much ignore the guy who ended up winning this match.
Why not have something that tastes good and is vitamin fortified too? You can have the best of both. Ovaltine is a good tasting product. Excellent.
Ovaltine tastes great, and it's great for you.
While the guy in the Ovaltine ad has a pretty good-looking mustache, he doesn't sound particularly convincing in his love for Ovaltine. He seems kind of like Ralphie from Christmas Story, who is, of course, very upset about the Ovaltine commercial buried in the decoder thing that he was waiting for in the mail. So yes, because this is WCW Prime, we do have commercials left in, which include something for a Nerf ball Zuka, which, I don't know, I was a little too old at this point for that sort of deal. Batman Forever coming out on VHS, which I referenced that movie with the McDonald's burger a couple of weeks back. A sander from Ryobi. I'm pretty sure that this would be better than above average Mike Sanders, although I can't really confirm that. And then, of course, a ubiquitous ad for 1-800-COLLECT, which, as my public service to you, I'm going to share that 1-800-COLLECT still exists. I never used it back in the day because those were just total creatures of the 1990s. I was a 10-10, 3-2-1 man because I think it was a little bit lower priced than the rest of them. In kind of reading about these in retrospect, the 10-10, 3-2-1 doesn't really seem to come up as much as 1-800-COLLECT, 1-800-CALL-ATT, and 10-10-220, which you'd see the ads for all the time. But yes, 1-800-COLLECT still exists to this day, apparently. And someone from Vice.com has revealed that 1-800-COLLECT charges a $10.63 connection fee along with a $3.99 per minute charge for an in-state payphone call from Virginia. So if it was out of state, I presume it would be more. And of course, this is in an era of cell phones, which I don't get it. It seems like one of those things that just died, you know, about 15 or so years ago more. Coming up next, we have Eddie Guerrero in action, and he's still wearing the tights with the top on it. I always kind of see Eddie as not really having evolved until he lost that top part. So this is in his early WCW days, and he's taking on the other Dusty, Dusty Wolf, an enhancement talent who you may know more from the World Wrestling Federation in the late 80s, who of course was known as Dusty Wolf there until Dusty Rhodes showed up, and with the WWF not wanting to have two Dusties around, because Lord knows you would get Dusty Rhodes confused with anybody else in the world, they made him change his name to Dale Wolf. So kind of a interesting little matchup here. He's got years of experience here, and they go into that on commentary. And I don't know if Dusty's really excited about somebody who shares the same first name as him, but in listening, it seems like somebody has slipped the dream of Quaalude.
Dusty Wolf, how long have you been repping?
Probably at least 12 years.
Not probably, not pro. Whoa, wait a minute.
What?
Gobble, 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 gobble. Hey, nope.
I'm telling you, they're getting me, you in that hat.
If you must know, Dusty Wolf debuted in the summer of 1982, so he's about 13 years in at this point. But, oh boy, that went off in a really weird direction where Dusty is making his point and then all of a sudden just kind of does the gobble-gobble, which seems to be the thing to do at Thanksgiving on this show when you just kind of lost your train of thought or you're not entirely, you know, if you really don't know what to say. I must admit that I have some regrets about missing parts of wrestling in the early 2000s and checking out when I did. And one of them is with regard to the rise of Eddie Guerrero. And of course, he did disappear from WWE for a period in the early 2000s where he ended up on the first Ring of Honor show. And then I'm talking more about his comeback a little bit later, which of course culminated in him beating Brock Lesnar for the WWE title at No Way Out 2004. I really kind of want to put myself in a time machine, take myself now and go back to February 2004 and experience that match when it happened, because in the moment, it just feels like something that would have been so surprising, because we didn't know that Brock Lesnar was going to leave at that time and leave so soon. So it seemed like such a shocking thing that he would be on top of the world. And he's somebody that I always enjoyed, even in WCW, coming back and watching in 1997. The Latino World Order at least allowed him to show some personality. He's a little bland, Eddie is, in the mid-90s, and he's still pretty smooth in the ring. He does a drop toe hold into an arm bar, which I particularly enjoyed, but he's not quite all the way there yet because there's really no character to him at this time, and that's kind of the missing piece of the puzzle there, that little Latino heat that didn't come along until later. Cruz, again, makes an effort to try and tie the prime in with other shows, as he mentions a match that Eddie had on Nitro for the television title against the champion Johnny B. Badd, which sounds like a terrific match because Johnny B. Badd in 1995 was really working on all cylinders at this point. I recently watched the World War III pay-per-view. God knows why. I mean, there I am on my Twitter account at GF Allentown Pod on Monday night watching Raw and complaining about the Paul Heyman promo and hearing it for the 400th consecutive time and complaining about Triple H coming out like, oh, okay, he's going to be the fifth man. So the average age of the people in the match is well over 40 years old. And yet I'm watching World War III from 1995 in the morning and actually kind of enjoying it. I don't know what it says about me, but what it says is that I'm trying to do research for the show. Anyway, Johnny B. Badd, really good in 1995, and it would have been great to see him continue in WCW, except that, of course, he had some issues with some storylines that were pitched to him or whatever. So I'm going to have to seek out that Eddie versus Johnny B. Badd time limit draw that aired on a Nitro shortly before this. Eddie is in control for much of this match, but Wolf does get control for a little bit, but he misses his own version of the SD Jones Memorial Charge to the corner, and then we get the delayed vertical and frog splash for the victory, which Dusty, as I said, he's still a little addled from that quaalude. He calls it a jackknife for a second, and Cruz quickly corrects into a frog splash. There is a bizarre Dusty story just kind of thrown in the middle of this match that I have to share.
Remember we were out, where were we last week on the road with Prime? We were somewhere out there the night.
We were in Macon, Georgia.
We were in Macon, Georgia, and we was out there. And remember the two girls came up to us after one autograph from you and me?
Yeah.
The Apple Sisters, remember? And I said, what's your name? And they said, CD and Corey. What? What? And you went off with CD.
I've always wanted to see Macon, Georgia.
I really have no idea what Dusty was trying to say there, but it did kind of give me the idea for a feature film that I'm proud to announce the initial development on, which would be, I don't have a working title yet, but it is Dusty Rhodes and Chris Cruz just going across the southeastern United States, just going from town to town, looking to pick up women and have a good time. I'm thinking of it as part Wedding Crashers, part Smokey and the Bandit. I'm already thinking about reaching out to Michael Cera to play Christopher Cruz and to Fat Jonah Hill to play Dusty Rhodes. I don't know what he's weighing at these days, so we're going to have to check in with him on that before we can proceed any further.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Come back to Cruz and Dusty with the turkey kind of prancing around still behind them. And Cruz is going to throw it to a Dungeon of Doom video. But before that, he's trying to make a point about the World War III Battle Royal and how they have two new members in the Dungeon of Doom, which would be the One Man Gang and Hugh Morris, which was being pronounced Hugh Morris and Humorous at various points on WCW television. Kind of the interesting thing here is that he does refer to it as being for the title, which was not the case on certain other WCW shows, which were recorded longer in advance, where the thought was, well, it was a number one contender type deal, and that the winner would get a shot at the world champion somewhere down the road. So giving credence to the thought that this was all sort of booked on the fly, the weirdness of getting the WCW title off Hogan and then putting it up for grabs in this battle royal. So as Cruz is trying to make this point and throw it to the video, Dusty just kind of blows off what he's talking about, just kind of goes off on his own thing.
Well, Dusty, you know, with World War III coming up, the Dungeon of Doom has got two new members, and they are looking forward to perhaps one of the members of the Dungeon of Doom coming out as the new World Heavyweight Champion.
You see that goblet back there?
Yeah.
I told you, you got to be careful with him, because I'm trying hard to call him out. Watch this. When I call the turkey call, gobble, 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 he don't comprehend that.
Now, Dream, I love you, but we're all kind of having a little bit of trouble trying to comprehend what you're saying here. It's not just the turkey, believe me. I mean, it's all great fun and all, but I don't know what you're trying to do here. But also completely incomprehensible here is the Dungeon of Doom, for pretty much their entire run, just kind of an evil supergroup that we all remember for bad vignettes and just kind of Bray Wyatt-esque promos that just sort of go on and on and on. And this is in kind of the spirit of that, is you got Kevin Sullivan, the ringleader, and you have King Curtis Iaukea just kind of hanging out over his shoulder as Sullivan's just kind of, or excuse me, Taskmaster, is just him talking about the World War III Battle Royal. Nothing interesting of note, although the Giant is sort of hanging out in the background there, and he actually gets to talk for a second, but, you know, it's not any good. And then we get new member Hugh Morris, who is just irritating as all hell. Bill DeMott, who I never even liked before the whole, he's a bully at NXT, he's bullying the people that he's training, although now that I think about it, I mean, with how apparently unpopular Enzo Amore is in certain quarters of the locker room, perhaps that's why he might have had a little bit more support as the trainer, because Enzo was apparently one of the people that he was pushing around and all that. But I really don't like him, and I really just never did. I want to get that out on record. One Man Gang, of course, said, you know, the character is fine, but this is 1995 here. He's going to win the U.S. title shortly after this, which just seems absolutely insane and crazy. Because we all know, all of us who, in our hearts, we all know that he was better as Akeem. As a jive dancing, whatever, Easter egg. And then we get kind of the capper to the promo here.
It looks like this is a family matter.
It's the bigger love of the family.
Now look, I'm not going to spend 10 minutes here talking about the television show Family Matters, lest I become a complete parody of myself in spinning everything to talk about 80s and 90s sitcoms. Although if you want that, there is a great satire out there that Joe Morata of the Our Vantage Point podcast made of me called Greetings from Allen-Town, where I don't know how he got my voice so down in my speaking patterns, I guess from listening, you know, I've now done like 40 shows here, where he's looking at a specific episode of Home Improvement, which guest starred Christopher McDonald, who you probably know from Happy Gilmore as Shooter McGavin, and it is outstanding, so find that out, it is on YouTube. Now, back to the Dungeon of Doom here. Okay, the laugh there by all of them at the end, and I don't know if it was because of Hugh Morris or if this is just sort of a generic evil heel laugh. It is my sincere hope that Mike Crockett of the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing, on that show they do a heel laugh Hall of Fame. I really hope, and I'll lobby against this to keep the Dungeon of Doom out. I haven't gone through the complete Hall of Fame yet, so if it's already in, let me just express my disappointment, but I will take steps to keep that particular heel laugh out, because it felt really kind of forced and phony, kind of like Dr. Evil's crew in the Austin Powers one when they felt the need to sit around and laugh at the end there. So Dusty is there with the turkey still. And this turkey is just kind of hopping around behind him. And you can't really see, you can only see like the top of the turkey, which makes it really kind of weird because Dusty's a wide guy. So he's got plenty of room to maneuver and he's got plenty of space to hide from the camera. But honestly, if you're looking at this turkey, and this is why you have to watch the videos that I'm watching every week, because, you know, to kind of check me on what I'm seeing here. This turkey who's kind of behind Dusty looks like he's just masturbating behind Dusty. He could be masturbating because we can't see what's going on. He's just kind of hopping around. He's moving one arm in kind of a manner that would suggest that maybe that is taking place. But of course, we all know that turkeys can't masturbate, right?
Bottom line, Christopher Cruz, thankful of WCW Prime to allow us to be crazy like this.
Well, as Layla Maloney says at the end of Big Daddy, when the little boy on the stand stands up for the band Styx, I think we can all agree on that. Get a series of ads here for Vector Man for the Sega Genesis, Levi's, and then a Tough Man competition, the Tough Man World Championships, coming on pay-per-view December 2nd, 1995. And there, Butterbean is all over the advert for this, but it doesn't appear like Butterbean was still competing in the Tough Man competitions at this point. He had tried his hand at boxing in like legitimate boxing setting and had failed at that. And of course, we as wrestling fans remember him for his two appearances in the WWF. Of course, the second one is the more memorable one at WrestleMania 15, laying waste to Bart Gunn in that Brawl for All aftermath nonsense. But what people don't remember is the weird Butterbean versus Marvelous Mark Merrow thing at In Your House Degeneration X in December of 1997, probably because it happened so soon after the Montreal Screwjob. But back to this Tough Man pay-per-view from December of 95, I could not find anything on this. And there's a Wikipedia page and a CageMatch or whatever page for literally everything in the world, except for this. I couldn't find out who was in the finals, who was competing. The only references I could really find for it, and I spent like 40 minutes on this, it like completely derailed my Sunday afternoon, was a New York Times article published about 2 or 3 days after the pay-per-view where some writer poo-pooed the whole notion of Tough Man contests and then kind of went into MMA and how it was being banned in New York around that time. Of course, times have changed in the 22 years since then. So our next bout here is a true classic. The Barrio Brothers, comprised of Ricky Santana and Fidel Sierra, who you may know best as the Cuban Assassin. So he's making his first Greetings from Allentown appearance since episode 6, when he faced off, I believe, against Ric Flair, of all people, facing Scott and Steve Armstrong. So not Brad, not Bob, and not Brian, who we know as the Road Dog, of course. But they are in the top 5 of Armstrong family members who are wrestlers. Seeing the Armstrongs here reminds me that I should probably do a show on Smoky Mountain Wrestling at some point, as the Armstrongs were mainstays there. I'm thinking particularly Bullet Bob Armstrong, the patriarch of that wrestling family. This match here between two teams that were not, well, I guess the Barrio Brothers were almost pure jobbers, because one of the few wins that I could find for them was actually over Scott and Steve Armstrong earlier in 1995 in August at a TV taping. I could not find what TV show that was on. However, they picked up another win in 1996 against Rick Garcia and Mike Winner. Some of the WCW job guy names are really, really good. But this, I have not been this excited for a match of this type since I found out that there was a Barry Horowitz and Steve Lombardi against Scott Casey and Leaping Lanny Poffo match out there that aired on primetime probably in like 1988. So we'll see how this goes here. The beauty of WCW Prime is, where else are you going to see the Barrio Brothers walking to the ring, getting the full entrance, complete with the one of the guys talks to the camera and you can't quite understand what he's saying, but he is cutting a promo to the camera. Where, on what other show are you going to get such magic and wonder? The two Armstrongs here, Scott and Steve. Scott, of course, in more recent vintage, is known as the Authority Evil Ref in WWE in 2013 and 2014. It's kind of funny because when he turned up at WrestleMania 30, I hadn't been watching again for that long, so I didn't have that context because I hadn't gone back and watched the 2013 Raws or pay-per-views that I had missed. So when he like did the run-in, I had no idea what the hell was going on and why he was there and what his whole deal was. Steve Armstrong, of course, had some success as a member of the Southern Boys with the great Tracy Smothers and is well-traveled. Of course, the Southern Boys eventually became the Young Pistols when they moved from the southeastern U.S. to Wyoming overnight for some reason. And he had a brief run in WWE, or WWF at the time, of course, as Lance Cassidy in kind of a cowboy gimmick, which seems to, I don't know if they were trying to combine something or evoke Butch Cassidy, which I know could lead, this is very dangerous ground, it could lead to a rant against the current Boston Bruins coach Bruce Cassidy, who is nicknamed Butch, but I'm gonna hold off for the benefit of those of you in the audience. The Armstrongs, to their credit, though, have outstanding red satin jackets that just say Armstrong in big capital letters on the back. And I'm not even a huge Armstrongs fan or anything like that, but I want that jacket. Like, I just wanna walk around in that jacket. I feel like when I go to Tennessee next June, I feel like I'll have a lot of cachet there, even though I'll be more in Nashville than in Eastern Tennessee, you know, the land of Smoky Mountain, where that might be a little bit more over. The term the Barrio Brothers, I thought that was a little strange to call a tag team, because I've always thought of the term Barrio as something of a derogatory word, or at least it kind of strikes me as such. It of course is a word meaning a Spanish-speaking poor neighborhood. So you have these two guys from Cuba, and you know that it is what it is. I mean, you know, we're not going to stand up for, you know, the enemy of the United States country as it was at that time, and looks like it's slowly creeping back that way given recent foreign policy moves by the current administration. So we have a bit of a chase to start the match here, and Ricky Santana, he lands a really bad spinning heel kick. It was, I only gave it 2 Owens out of 10 for that heel kick. It was not very well done at all. He did not get very good height on it. I think he barely got above the belly button on that one. Then Steve Armstrong comes flying off the top rope into Santana, and then they get a double drop kick on Sierra, who comes into the ring. And I'm just thinking that Jesse Ventura, if he was on commentary here, he would be going absolutely apeshit about the fact that there was no tag and there's just blatant double teaming going on. Also kind of makes me wonder of Jesse Ventura on a show like Prime, where he could just cut loose. He would probably be sharing conspiracy theories about the Oklahoma City thing, since that had happened earlier in 95, or, you know, certain other things that were going on in the news with militias and stuff like that during that year. We get the test of strength here, so the match is slowed down quite a bit. So Dusty, he's going to fill in these gaps for us, don't worry, because we're not going to be lacking for entertainment. This is not in SD Jones versus the Hangman 10-minute draw. Oh, no, 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 no. Dusty will not stand for that. Dusty decides to take a moment to give the guy who drives the ring truck a shout-out, Or at least I think he does.
What a job Ed Auburn does driving the ring truck. I mean, he is one of the best.
Is that what he does?
Yeah, he is one of the best. No, he's audio. No, he ain't J. Paul's audio. Ed is, what do you think Ed does?
I don't know. What does he do?
He has earphones on.
No, he chases the apple sisters.
He chases the apple sisters. Yeah, all right.
All right, here we go. Back to the bar, brother.
I feel like this is something that I could look into from the closing credits, because WCW would play the closing credits on their shows, because famously back in the day, you'd see Virgil Runnels as executive producer when Dusty was an active performer. I don't really care about that right now. I just thought it was weird how Dusty gives him a shout out for driving the ring truck and then is unsure if he's actually audio or whatever. Feels like there's a big difference between being the audio guy and the guy who drives the ring truck. I don't think there's a whole lot of crossover there. Santana gets monkey flipped. He seems to be doing all the heavy lifting here on this team with Sierra, although I guess to each according to his ability and this and that kind of stuff. They go to an ad break in the middle of this match, like it's some sort of Raw match. And I'm just saying, we must not interrupt this important match here on the Prime. But since we have to, we get another ad for Ovaltine, which is a different guy than the guy with the mustache from before. We get Van's boots. By the way, the Ovaltine guy just says it tastes great, which I say it's less filling, but he says it tastes great. Then we have, in a betrayal of her time with the World Wrestling Federation at WrestleMania 4, we get Vanna White for the Perfect Smile system. I don't think she recorded this specifically for a WCW show. I'm just kind of making light of the fact that you're seeing Vanna White in this context here. The only thing notable there is that the P.O. box that you would send your check or money order to for the Perfect Smile system is in Framingham, Massachusetts, which held the distinction for a very long time as being the largest town in the United States, but recently they decided to become a city and they just elected their first mayor, which I guess for an administrative perspective, it's probably better for them to be a city, but they kind of lose their distinction there, because, you know, would you rather be the biggest town in the U.S. or just another city where they're probably about the sixth or seventh largest city in the state of Massachusetts? You get an arm wringer into a chop there by the Armstrongs, who, by the way, I love how they love to work the arm here. The two guys named Armstrong just spend the entire match working the arm. It's pretty good. So they do the arm wringer and chop, but they don't do the full FBI thing because Smothers is not there, you know, which includes the elbow drop. Fidel Sierra finally gets in the ring. He gets arm dragged, as, you know, it's got to be an arm move. And now we get to the part of the show that I played in the intro where Cruz does not want to clubber a turkey because he loves animals. And yes, it's one of those things where we eat turkey for Thanksgiving, but I prefer not to focus on how the turkey might have gotten there. Although, in my area in Massachusetts, there are wild turkeys roaming around everywhere. Even in like an urban setting like Brookline, which borders Boston, there are wild turkeys roaming the streets because we don't want to take the steps to kind of control that population in cities. And I don't get it, okay? I've had to like sit in my car in Melrose, Mass and wait for like 8 turkeys to cross the street while trying to get to a train station, and it pisses me off because those turkeys are mean, okay? You don't want to fight them. Okay? Anyway, so this is where Dusty claims he can't eat ham because he's Jewish, which I say, L'chaim dream. The Cubans control this match as they discuss the WCW title being held up. So I give them credit for actually keeping up with the storylines here on the Prime. And we get kind of a blah heat segment here, where the heat is on one of the Armstrongs, to the point where I didn't even note which. Oh, I guess I did write down that it was Steve who was in peril here. But Santana hits knees on a splash attempt, tag to Scott. We get an O'Connor roll by Santana, but the ref is trying to get Fidel Sierra out of the ring, And Steve takes advantage of Santana's predicament, going for a pin as the referee is distracted, and he lands a bulldog on him, and they get the 1-2-3 there as Sierra tries to make the save, but he just can't get there. I don't know. I mean, this was an okay match for what it was. Certainly the commentary was plenty interesting, with Dusty expressing his solidarity with the Jewish people. And then he crams in a Bob Dylan reference at the end of it all.
And Bob Dylan would say, "What a simple twist of fate. Like thieves in the night, dog strong, escape with a victory."
Wonder if Dusty ever went to synagogue with Bob Dylan. So it does kind of make sense that he would mention one of the most prominent Jewish musical artists of all time shortly after talking about how he can't eat ham because he's Jewish. Anyway, we get an ad break here. Of course, the usual 1-800-COLLECT. Twix. Take a time out for Twix. There are two ads again for Vector Man for the Sega Genesis. And for whatever reason, this game escaped my notice back in 95. And I wasn't as interested in the non-sports games. And looking it up, I was like, was this game a huge bust or something that I didn't know about? Apparently, though, GamePro and other publications raved about the advanced graphics of this game for the time period. And there was a sequel, a follow-up to Vector Man that was made later on. And then finally, we get a commercial for Time Life Music Guitar Rock. And this is where I start to feel good.
Bad as a overdrive with Guitar Rock, the hottest collection of rock hits ever. Get Guitar Rock for just $9.99 on compact disc or double length cassette. That's 17 explosive hits. Other great guitar rock albums. Cancel anytime. Call now.
I love those Time Life infomercials, the ones that last for half an hour that you see on like the Bloomberg channel on like Saturday afternoons when there's no other programming going on. Like, I will actually sit there and I will watch the full half hour, because there's a lot of entertaining stuff that you can glean from it. I like the one, I think it was like Songwriters of the 70s or something, that's Tony Orlando and some woman who's flirting with Tony Orlando for the entire show. The Soft Rock Love Ballads, that one is a good one because it's got the two guys from Air Supply hosting it, and they got this table in the middle, and there's a thing of lemonade, and it does not get touched during the whole filming, because I'm watching that lemonade and it stays at the exact same level the entire time. So I wonder, is it actually lemonade, or did somebody urinate in that and is playing a joke? Probably not. But they start that show by saying, of course, the two guys from Air Supply, "Hello, I'm Graham Russell, and I'm Russell Hitchcock, and together..." And immediately, I always chime in. "And together, we're Graham Russell Hitchcock." Because, of course, you know, you get the nice little before and after, like a Wheel of Fortune puzzle there. So, yeah, the Time Life infomercials are always rather amusing. You don't see them as much nowadays. I think that there might have been an ownership change somewhere along the line. I also miss that one that Bowser, the old singer from like 60s, would show up for some reason, and then he would kind of flex. He was like the Buff Bagwell of the Time Life infomercial world.
There's Sunday night, only on pay-per-view, it's World War III.
Jesus, it feels bad enough that the world is all strange and screwed up right now, and now that a world war has broken out, I gotta order it on pay-per-view. Oh, wait, he means the World War III pay-per-view from WCW. Okay. All right, forget what I just said there. So, silly me. I mean, I thought that World War III would be fought in cyberspace rather than on pay-per-view. But anyway, Gene Okerlund with the World War III Control Center here. And of course, with a big focus on the 60-man battle royal, or as I call it, the way to get Mark Starr on the show. Let me tell you something about these battle royals. Yes, it does prove that WCW had a very bloated roster, and it probably didn't need to be 60 guys because you have the three rings, which leads to a really screwy seating arrangement. Unless you were in that middle square cutout right at ringside, because then you would have a really prime seat for all three rings. But, I mean, how many seats are there? They're like less than 70, something like that. Anyway, I watched this pay-per-view recently, and I had not sat through the entire thing in the past. I've watched a match here, a match there, and it is shockingly good. For when you talk about WCW 1995, the mind goes to a certain place, especially given some of the stuff that happened at Halloween Havoc that everybody makes fun of, and the Hogan ego trip on this show. There is so much good stuff, like Johnny B. Badd versus DDP in the opening match, which, as I said, Johnny B. Badd was just really on a roll at the time. Sting versus Ric Flair, another one of their very good, albeit maybe formulaic, but still a very good match between the two. The Japanese women and Bull Nakano putting on a real show. And Bull Nakano, I swear, if you could clone any woman's wrestler in history and put her into today's product, we need more Bull Nakanos in wrestling for a diversity of body type, a diversity of styles. You know, it just makes sense. Like, Nia Jax is just one person, and she's relatively inexperienced. She's not as good as Bull Nakano. So that's why I want to clone her rather than to, you know, whatever. It'll be fine. But it was a shockingly good show. But as I said, the Hogan ego thing, which was really weird because he was making all these steps to, I don't know, in effect, try to make himself look good. And it's very much a head-scratcher because Hogan is not a moron, okay? He did not get to where he is by being stupid. And what I don't understand is why he thought this would work. It's kind of, he did not really put much thought into the things that he was throwing out there. I'm not talking about burning the Observer. That's actually kind of hilarious in retrospect, and makes it really memorable. But getting pulled out of the ring that way, and not even losing a battle royal cleanly, is just really kind of crazy because it's so innocuous. Nobody's going to remember and say, wow, can't believe he got eliminated from the battle royal. It's not like he got eliminated by Mike Winner or anything like that. But yeah, that 60-man battle royal, I could watch. And I posted this on Twitter a few days ago. I could watch that parade of WCW guys as David Penzer or whoever it was they had announcing all the names in a row, like one after the other. Like, Pez Watley is there. In 1995, Joey Maggs, Max Muscle. I didn't even think he was still there, but yeah. Anyway, in the control center, they are going over the one-on-one matchups, a lot of which I just mentioned, and they had little cartoon drawings of the people on each side, so like a cartoon drawing of Sting next to one of Flair. I thought that was a pretty neat touch there. It's not something that I've seen very often in wrestling. So that does it for that, and we get promotional consideration for a provided by Spawn the video game. Todd McFarlane, who was the Spawn guy, and then I remember him more for buying a lot of baseballs during that 1998 home run chase, which proved to not be the greatest investment in the world, as it turned out. Slim Jims, of course, because Randy Savage is on payroll, Godzilla figures, and then a video game based on the movie Demolition Man. So it cuts back to the American Dream, Chris Cruz, and the masturbating turkey, and Dusty starts choking Cruz there.
American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, and Christopher Cruz, WCW Prime Thanksgiving Special. You know what turkeys we do to them at Thanksgiving? You know, we eat them. Maybe the turkey would like to do that to you, because I'm camouflaged. Would you like that turkey?
What?
Yes, yes. Thanksgiving special on Prime.
Boy, they really gave us a long cooldown period after that Barrio Brothers versus the Armstrongs match. A lot of ads, a lot of playful stuff just thrown in the middle of the show because we get an ad for a string trimmer slash mower combo, which sounds like a pretty cool item to have. I know I hate having to, you know, mow the lawn and I have to go back and get the string trimmer. It's just really a bother. I wish I had one device for that. Of course, I also wish I lived on land that didn't have two big hills in both the front and the backyard, but that's neither here nor there. We finally get to our next bout, which features the Nature Boy, Ric Flair, accompanied by Brian Pillman of the Horsemen, and he is taking on Bart Sawyer. Now, Bart Sawyer is known mainly for two things in my mind, or at least the stuff that I picked up in my research. One is that in 1996 in the USWA, he was teaming with a young Flex Cavana, yes, Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, and won the USWA tag team titles alongside the young Rock and up-and-coming Rocky Maivia, or that's what he would be a few months after that. But years earlier in Sawyer's career, he showed up in Portland territory around 1990 and 91, playing a character that was to resemble Bart Simpson. Of course, you know, to match his first name, and he had done his hair up in like a blonde, spiky thing to make himself look a little bit like Bart Simpson, and he was kind of going around and, I guess, pranking guys, it seems. Kind of the idea that I had many, many episodes ago for a babyface Owen Hart character in the early 90s that, I don't know, I guess, see, Vince didn't know about The Simpsons. Vince might only be finding out about The Simpsons now. Like, Vince is somewhere, McMahon, he's watching season 2 of The Simpsons on a DVD right now because in a pop culture perspective, he's only up to 1990. And The Simpsons is just so unbelievably hot. Yes, they had merchandise out the wazoo and in commercials for Butterfinger and all that. And the Butterfinger stuff would last a lot longer, but you could get Bart Simpson on pretty much any bit of merchandise. I had a Bart Simpson New England Patriots shirt, which sounds okay, but the Patriots were a complete joke in 1991. So the fact that I had a Bart Simpson defensive dude shirt that had like a Patriots logo on there is just really strange. And oh my God, I wish I still had that shirt because I'm pretty sure that Fat Boy Pete at age 12 stretched it out enough that I could probably still fit into it. And that would be one hell of a piece of memorabilia to have. So yeah, kind of a fun gimmick for Sawyer earlier in his career. For Flair at this point in time, of course, he's going to win the WCW title at Starrcade coming up. But right now, you get the Horsemen reformed. He loses to Sting at World War III. It doesn't really affect him too much, but he's got Pillman there with him. Good to see that they put aside their differences dating back to 1993. Of course, Pillman would evolve into that loose cannon character a little bit later, and at this point it's not there. You can see maybe a sprinkling, a dusting of it, maybe like loosening cannon at that time. Flair is in the purple, which I can't make heads or tails over what Flair wears at a given time, like why he wears green on the times he wears green. Like, that's the question I would ask Flair if I ever met him. Like, yeah, how did you decide what color you would wear for a given match? Here, I noticed that Flair is missing a knee pad. And when Flair is missing a knee pad, that usually means he was up to some kind of shenanigans, either the night before or the night before that, or maybe even 20 minutes before the match. Who knows? Of course, this is one of those, I believe, Universal tape. I don't even know where this arena is because I couldn't find out a damn thing about when this was taped or whatever. I don't think it was too far before the actual air date on November 20th. Cruz says that Dusty can't be objective here and that he will be biased calling this match, which I found interesting. Is he referring to the Dusty Flair feud from nearly a decade before, or is he referring to the turmoil between Flair and Dusty that happened towards the end of Dusty's run as a booker in 88 and the tensions between them in 1991 before Flair was fired by Jim Herd in July? Who knows? It might just be, you know, just that whole Flair Rhodes rivalry, which is big enough to have a whole documentary or WWE Network special on them. Sawyer, even though he looked like Bart Simpson earlier in his career for his Portland game, he kind of looks like a proxy Shane Douglas here, which is kind of fun, given that you have Dick Flair on the other side there. So you can kind of pretend that this is a Shane Douglas, Ric Flair match. Like I always say when I see Flair in this sort of spot, and I mentioned this when he faced the Cuban Assassin back in episode 6, it is kind of fun to see Flair doing these preliminary match spots where he's just kind of taking it easy. He gets all kind of offense in a row. He's not getting press slammed as part of the Flair formula. He's not getting slammed off the top rope or anything. You know, he's just kind of having an easy peasy sort of win. He goes for the they go for the test of strength spot there, and Flair doesn't even put an arm up. He just kind of kicks him in the stomach like right away, like making absolutely no mistake as to what was to come. When he lays in the chops in the corner, the crowd is not wooing along at that point, which is actually kind of refreshing. I kind of put myself on guard there, at least in this particular viewing. Pillman is laying in the cheap shots from the outside. Like I said, he's loosening cannon. He's not quite the loose cannon yet. And Flair, of course, this is the kind of match that he can win with the figure four leg lock. Of course, his joke for a long time was that he never actually won a match with the figure four, but in reality here, he's working on the left leg and knee of Sawyer for pretty much the entire time. You get more Pillman cheap shots. This one from the outside. Earlier, Sawyer was on the floor. And Dusty, he promises a turkey call after the match as part of the turkey moo match of the week that is coming up. So I am waiting with bated breath for that one. And the figure four does finish in this match. Like I said, it's always fun to see Ric Flair in just kind of a relaxed setting. You're used to seeing him in a main event where he's going 20, 25 minutes. And, you know, it's an intense match and everything is on the line if he's the world champion and all that. So this is really kind of like a day at the spa for Ric Flair. I have not seen the 30 for 30 on Flair that aired last week on ESPN. I'm sure I'm going to run into it at some point. I'm a little bit wary, though, of the way they do documentaries. Now, with the way WWE owns so much footage, and you can't do a real documentary on anybody unless you have some sort of cooperation from WWE, unless you're doing a documentary on the great Muta, and they're probably not going to be doing that. And even then, you would still need WWE for the WCW footage on him. So my point is that you're never going to get a fully honest accounting of everything, I don't think, because they're always going to kind of be a little bit beholden to WWE. Not going to say that they're going to get final cut on everything, but they certainly, just by virtue of having the rights to literally almost everything, are going to have a huge say in what's in the documentary and what's not in the documentary. So yeah, if I'm wrong about that with regards to the Flair 30 for 30, let me know, and I'll certainly check it out right away.
Time now for our prime match of the week. It involves a somewhat discouraged Mr. Wonderful.
Hey, you didn't believe me when I say I could call a turkey up? All I got to do is use the right turkey call. And thousands of people went to call a turkey. They said, Chris, see how he reacts to that? I have got a turkey, I promise. He's right here, right in front of us.
And right now, the world, don't peck him. Do not peck him.
Yeah,
when I'm
don't
talking.
Peck me.
Listen, and right yeah. now, in front of the whole world, this turkey right here will bring us the move match of the week. You said turkeys can't move.
Turkeys can't move.
This turkey can move. Okay, turkey, I'm going to give you a countdown for the move match of the week. It's Mr. Wonderful, right or wrong?
Right.
Yes, sir, and he is a little distraught. Move match of the week. Okay, turkey.
The sheer joy that Dusty Rhodes gets from announcing the Moo match of the week. I wish I could be that happy at really any point in my life. Seriously. It's really what it's all about. It's just pure, unadulterated entertainment. And yes, as they mentioned, we have Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, who was going through a thing here in late 1995, and he'll be taking on the Cobra, who I'll get to in a second. And you could hear the beginning of Cobra's weird music with the with that weird, ugh, I hate that music. And Orndorff, yes, he was plagued by a real bout of self-doubt, and this was, I guess, the second round of this that had occurred for him. Earlier in 95, he was feeling down about himself after a loss to the Macho Man Randy Savage, until he was visited by a medium, a psychic medium. And by the way, psychics keep turning up on these shows, either in commercials or now Gary Spivey, no relation to Dan Spivey, or at least as far as I know, he shows up. And to his credit, he actually does help turn things around for Orndorff, who then, apparently later, he breaks a mirror. And as we all know, in superstition or whatever, black magic, whatever, breaking a mirror is 7 years of bad luck. It's not just a line in a Stevie Wonder song called Superstition. It is apparently a real thing. So Wonderful is trying to get his mojo back here, and as it turned out, he eventually would, and then he would get attacked by the Horseman, and basically a career-ending injury angle. And this is before the end of calendar year 1995. So, hey, I mean, you know, it was a good try. It's in, I guess, the WrestleCrap Hall of Fame, but, and it probably should be, mainly for the weird, great gazoo looking thing that Gary Spivey has on his head that also looks like a Brillo pad. It looks like a football helmet if it was a Brillo pad. And of course, Orndorff's probably most memorable thing in 95 was the shower fight with Vader, which of course has given him a reputation that will last forever, him taking down Vader while wearing shower shoes. But Orndorff's career came to an end around this time. The Cobra, Jeff Farmer, very interesting character in WCW history, as he is probably best known for being one in a long line of fake stings. It seems like there was an awful lot of fake stings, probably more fake stings than there were any other character in wrestling history. It's possible that there are more fake Gorgeous Georges out there, and there's probably other characters where the gimmick wasn't trademarked or something, and some bunch of guys stole it for the indies or whatever. But Sting as a guy, you had Barry Windham playing Sting at that Halloween Havoc in 1990. You had Jeff Farmer, as I mentioned, that you had whoever it was that was Sting at Road Wild in 97 that helped Hogan regain the title from Lex Luger. I think it was Kevin Nash who was Sting in that case. I haven't watched that show in a very long time, but the way I've been watching these WCW pay-per-views just randomly recently, between World War III 95, Halloween Havoc 94, I'll probably be watching that tonight. I'm going to stay up till 4 in the morning or something. Interesting note about Jeff Farmer is that he is the brother of Dr. Paul Farmer, who is a doctor of actually some note. He is, and I quote, an American anthropologist and physician who is best known for his humanitarian work providing suitable health care to rural and under-resourced areas in developing countries, beginning in Haiti. Co-founder of international social justice and health organization Partners in Health, he is known as, quote, the man who could cure the world, as described in the book Mountains Beyond Mountains by Tracy Kidder. So some high praise for Dr. Paul Farmer, the brother of Jeff Farmer. And it should also be noticed that on Jeff Farmer's Wikipedia page, it says that he is the brother of Dr. Paul Farmer. But on Dr. Paul Farmer's Wikipedia page, it does not say that he is the brother of wrestler Jeff Farmer, or of the Cobra, or of Fake Sting, or any of that. Jeff Farmer, he did have a story when he came in as the Cobra not too long before this, in September of 1995. He was immediately put in a feud with Sergeant Craig Pittman, and Cobra debuted on WCW Worldwide of all shows on September 9th of 1995, so the same week as Monday Nitro, and he is on the C Show. He defeated Bobby Starr and was using a Cobra Clutch Slam as his finisher. And the announcers, Heenan and Okerlund, on that show apparently went into his backstory there of he served in the Gulf War with Sergeant Craig Pittman, and Cobra was abandoned in the desert and then was reported AWOL back at camp. And Cobra lost all rank and respect. So what do you do when you're in that kind of situation? Well, he trained to become a pro wrestler so that he could get revenge on Sergeant Craig Pittman. Instead of, you know, doing what you think he might do, which is wait for the end of a center stage taping in Atlanta and then ambush Pittman on the way out, or ambush him at Universal Studios. No, he instead decides to go the full honorable route and train to become a pro wrestler. And they have this sort of mini feud where it's kind of almost like a modern WWE feud, where they kind of traded victories and nobody really got anywhere. Because, you know, within a year, Farmer is in the Fake Sting role and Sergeant Craig Pittman is exactly what he always was. Now, Orndorff, to start here, he's doing a lot of stalling. And it's a reflection of this great character that he had going. It really is a shame that he got hurt when he did, because it would have been a fun little thing up through the first few months of 1996. I really don't see how Paul Orndorff fits with the NWO storyline. He probably would have fallen by the wayside even if he had stayed healthy. But it would have been a fun 5 or so months working that gimmick where he regains his mojo and him battling the Horsemen and stuff like that. So he's very, very slow to get himself ready here. And I am watching this video and I'm starting to panic a bit because I'm seeing there's not very much time left. So my thought is, oh no, am I not going to be able to see the finish to this match? And Orndorff, early on, he goes for a vertical suplex and Cobra actually slips out of it. And he then scores with an atomic drop, and then a cross body gets a two count. Cobra then hits two drop kicks, and Orndorff rolls to the outside and starts audibly calling for Gary Spivey to come back and help him. You can actually hear that on camera, which I thought was kind of fun. I don't know if he needed to bring his Brillo pad afro or what. And as Orndorff is outside the ring, the feed cuts off as he re-enters the ring. And I should have known this because in the WWF old school page that lists a lot of prime results through the episodes, it does say that the tape cut off. But I was kind of hoping that maybe this would, you know, have some sort of finish. And I thought about, well, how would I book the end of this match? And I'm not entirely sure how I would, because you got to keep the Cobra strong for his Pittman feud, but you want to play out the Paul Orndorff character as well. So I don't know if Spivey was there at the taping, So what I have them do is kind of have the two guys going at it, and then I have Cobra get an edge there, and then what happens is Spivey comes down to the ring and talks to Orndorff and actually does inspire him, and Orndorff picks up the win with the pile driver. I don't know, something like that. Hey, it was a good enough finish for the Great American Bash in 1991, and that's the first time that the words good enough and Great American Bash 1991 have ever been used in the same sentence. I mean, if it was all right for Luger to win the title that way with Harley Race just coming down and saying, God, now's the time, I'm sure it could have worked on an episode of WCW Prime in 1995, right? I mean, I don't think the Cobra was going to be picking up a win over Paul Orndorff. So yeah, I have no idea how this match actually ended because there's no result for it on that website. It's nothing you would find on historyofwwe.com because this is one of those, you know, tapings that God knows where it was, like I mentioned earlier. So, yeah. Fans, we're out of time. On to Prime. But that's okay. You know, I just invented the ending for that match, so we are good to go. But we're not done here. Oh no, not by a long shot, as we do have a few YouTube comments out there, so it is time for another episode of YouTube Comment Theater. So, like I said, there's only a few comments out there right now, so I'll just kind of go through a few of them. Alexander Arce says, Mr. Wonderful's music sounds messed up. And yes, that was another character thing that they were doing with him, is that his music was all screwy or whatever. I didn't quite understand what was going on there because I couldn't hear the music at all. Probably because my ears were just ruined after the Cobra's entrance earlier. And Wonderful, of course, had the... and he's wonderful, you know, one of the great themes in WCW history, just for how outlandish and over the top it was. Kind of similar to the whole Bobby Roode glorious thing of late, although the difference between Orndorff and Bobby Roode is that I've actually wanted to see a Paul Orndorff match, and I've never really desired to see a Bobby Roode match. Rockville Raven says, another WCW custom version for Prime Sports Network. They also did WCW Pro Chicago and New York. And yes, they would do these shows for various markets. WCW Pro in Chicago would feature a commentary from local sportscaster Jack Bruckhaus. I don't know if they did something similar in New York, but these are cool little things to, you know, kind of make it stand out. Of course, WWF had WWF New York at one point, which I think was effectively just Shotgun, and it didn't really stand out to me in the episodes that I've seen in any sort of way. Benjamin Hanley says, I don't know about anyone else, but I love the commercials. Haha. It's such a bonus to be able to watch these nostalgic episodes. I actually remember some of these bottom card obscure matches. I watched wrestling so obsessively as a 90s kid, but the commercials add to the whole experience. Please keep them in future uploads if possible. Haha. All right, you can lay off the ha-has there. I mean, you can express amusement. We know when to laugh, okay? We're smiling along with you. And yes, of course, I love the commercials here. I notice I've gone a little bit lighter on the musical interludes the last few weeks. Well, two of the four episodes, the last four episodes, have been WCW Prime, which come with these great commercials. So I don't quite need as many bumpers as I used to. And VCV World Championship Wrestling, which is done to make it look like it says WCW, says, you're absolutely right. Well, if that is what you're looking for, the real deal that had here, check it out. Sub the big boys are back, baby. Well, I don't think this person is very good at English. He don't talk English good. Not at all. So, and that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. I had considered bringing back Vinny Vegas Corner for this week and picking three NFL games. And then I wrote down the three picks that I would have made. And one of them was actually the Cleveland Browns. And I thought to myself, that's probably not the best idea, even though It seems insane that Blake Bortles is favored by 7.5 on the road against literally anybody. And I would have been looking forward to picking against the New York Giants as 10.5-point underdogs at home, because, God, that has been such an embarrassment for that franchise. And as a Patriots fan, I'm really sobbing my eyes out over that. What has been great is we're in the final days of Mike Francesa on WFAN, and he has done some of his best work in recent days going on rants about the Giants. It's been just fantastic stuff all the way around, and it honestly, it could not make me any happier. So on to next week's show here, to use a Bill Belichick-ism, and I'll be jumping back to the World Wrestling Federation and going to a year that I have not done a WWF show in. I can't believe it. Through 40 episodes, I have yet to visit the year 1990 in the WWF, and we'll be taking a look at the December 1st, 1990 episode of the Superstars of Wrestling, or was it just Superstars? I can't quite remember. On the show, they take a look back at the Survivor Series from Thanksgiving night in Hartford, Connecticut, mainly looking at the debut of this Kane the Undertaker guy, which, yes, it does say Kane the Undertaker in the update segment, and a look at the gobbledygooker. So I figure it's fitting to talk about the gobbledygooker, as the show will be released on Thanksgiving proper here in the United States. So that's why I have that show then, and I'm doing the WCW Thanksgiving show now. Also on the show, some fresh guys that I have yet to talk about, or I haven't talked about in a while. You got Paul Roma and Hercules as Power and Glory. They're in action. Jimmy Snuka in a kind of a weird spot for him in late 1990, just well past his peak and sell-by date from a World Wrestling Federation perspective. And the Orient Express, a tag team that I have not covered as of yet. Of course, we got Vince McMahon and Roddy Piper on the commentary, and they're joined by a third man in the booth late in the show. So I'll leave you in suspense for that there. I want to thank everybody for listening. As I said, wouldn't have been possible to get to 40 episodes without you. I hope you're here for the next 40 episodes as well. And do feel free to leave a review on iTunes for both me and the Pro Wrestling Only feed, or any of the Place to Be Nation feeds. And tell a friend. You know, word of mouth is always important. So if you enjoy this show, if you enjoy what I'm about, do tell a friend and turn somebody else onto it. You know, the multiplier effect. One tells one, tells one, and then we got something going here. So do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Okay, Chucky!